This is Geek Speak, episode 1 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio, 88.9 KOSP, Santa Cruz, and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks affiliated organizations. Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist, iOS developer, and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Lyle.
And we also have Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer and political junkie.
Hello.
Last week, we were talking about successful landing of SpaceX main thruster rocket on a barge, and they've been trying to do that for a while. And while we were talking about that, we were debating, like, how much savings really is that? You have some follow-up?
Or rather, we covered the story with the barge.
Yeah.
Then they landed the rocket on land.
Oh, I thought last week was the barge. I just assumed.
No, okay. That was on land.
All right, so they landed it on land, but we were questioning whether there was any value to them doing that.
Right. And first, a correction. I had referred to it as the Grasshopper. That was actually the test vehicle they used back in the day for vertical takeoff and landing.
Okay.
This was actually called the Falcon 9 first stage booster.
I'm pretty sure you called it Falcon 9 because we talked about it being only 991 steps from the Millennium Falcon.
So okay, then.
You did call it Night Falcon 9.
I also called it Grasshopper, which was incorrect.
All right.
So I'm making that correction. Right now, if you go to our website, you will be able to find some pictures of the booster after it's come back in. It looks like it's covered in soot. But other than that, basically undamaged.
Okay.
They're going to take it to the Kennedy Space Center launch pad, where they're going to anchor the rocket down and then fire the boosters. In other words, they're not going to launch the rocket into space. They're going to do a fixed burn test to see if there are any problems with it.
That makes sense.
And that's after, of course, a visual inspection. Then after it is, the burn goes off and hopefully, you know, doesn't go out of control and is a reasonable burn, it will then be housed at some other location, for example, as a museum piece. Because it's the first time something like that's been done, so it has some historical value.
That makes a lot of sense. So
the next one they build may be one that they relaunch.
When they lock it down and fire it, it could blow up, and then they won't get to save it as their first scientific thing.
That's true.
But in any case, it looks pretty cool.
But if it comes back and it blows up, then that's a pretty good idea that that's not going to work.
Yeah. So that's really cool. Okay, so they're going to... So did they talk at all about what kind of savings they can get by reusing these things?
Well, the fuel is $200,000. The whole flight for Falcon 9 was $60 million.
Okay.
So there's still going to be the money with regard to inspections and safety protocols, and there's still more money than just refueling it. But it's going to be a far sight lower than $60 million.
Right. Okay, cool. Good enough.
Some folks are hoping for two orders of magnitude cost reduction.
Right. Well, thanks for the update. So, Brian, this week your wife shared on Facebook, and this is how I found out about it, that you had mapped your Wi-Fi network at home. In fact, not just your Wi-Fi network, your entire community's Wi-Fi network. What the heck are you doing?
I'm getting frustrated, and what happens is I had about, I don't know, felt like an hour of free time at home. So what else am I going to do but try to figure out why my Wi-Fi is not working well? So my wife and I, our whole family, we actually have, six people on our network that share all of it. We have had problems with our Wi-Fi network for ages now, and it's been bugging me. We would have problems where I'd just get frustrated, and every couple of days we'd yank the plugs on the Comcast router and on our Wi-Fi routers and just shut the whole thing down, bring it back up, and then we'd get our speeds normal again, and it'd be working. And
I think this is a common problem.
I think
people get burned into this all the time.
Yeah, it is. And I used to be really into this. I really used to tweak my networks. I used to tweak my equipment and get the best network I could out of it. And I went so far as about 4 or 5 years ago, I bought a router that came pre-installed with the open source router software, DDWRT on mm-hmm. it, which gives you infinite tweakable possibilities, which was great at the time. But I haven't had the time to do any of that for years now.
This basically means that an open source project has drivers for the Wi-Fi. So instead of, it's like installing Linux on your home computer instead of Windows or Mac, you actually install this DDWRT library, which is like an operating system for the router.
Yeah,
Tomato is another version of that. Right. I use Tomato.
It is a full Linux operating system mm-hmm. for it. There's quite a bit of all the Linux
tools.
Built-in
firmware is also a full Linux operating system. There's a whole long history with regard to that, but it is more locked down.
Right.
And the providers don't always upgrade it in time. So there's vulnerabilities exist in people's home routers, and no one really knows about it because they don't actually control the firmware. And so geeks normally install these other tools so we can do what we want.
And DDWRT can be used to, violate the FCC specs for radios, because you can turn your radio emissions up higher.
Which was
really handy when we were living a quarter mile away from each other, or eighth of a mile, whatever it is.
And we actually spanned our networks, or I served you network from my home by us. You put a Wi-Fi access point in the trees, and mm-hmm. it was a really complicated process, but we did. I thought we used Tomato for that.
Nope, that was DDWRT.
Okay.
So you got the whole 150 yards on just two routers, or?
Yeah, we did.
The router in the one house, then one up in the trees because there wasn't line of sight between the two structures, and then a third one that was hooked up with a dish network or dish TV.
Reflector behind it, parabolic reflector behind it.
Yeah, pointing to the trees.
And then we also, when it rained, sometimes we'd have to trim the redwood trees to make a hole, because the branches would sag down, and so I had to trim them to make a hole line of sight. Yeah. And then line of sight, it worked pretty well.
Yeah, and trees are generally okay with regard to Wi-Fi. It was, but wet trees, water is not transparent to Wi-Fi. So
yeah, and I've since actually migrated off to other solutions too, thinking like if I bought it from somebody else, wouldn't it be better? So go on, you were saying.
Oh yeah, this all plays into the whole thing that was going on with my Wi-Fi, because I didn't know why sometimes it would just get flaky on me, and it wasn't always just my Wi-Fi. Sometimes it was the wired network, which the Apple TV is hooked up to, and things like that. So there's obviously multiple things going on, but what really triggered it was a week ago in 5 minutes, where I was just going through some stuff. I logged into my Comcast router. I, a long time ago, set up a password and a login into that. And the Comcast router includes not just the modem for the cable connection. It also has its own Wi-Fi in there. And I was using that sort of as a guest network. I could give somebody a password to my network, or they could use that.
And I know what's going to happen here. Go on.
So that had been set up
this
a long time ago.
This is why I don't have a Comcast router, but modem, by the way.
Well,
I have Comcast.
I just happened to realize there was logs on this, and I looked at it, and in the logs it said about every 20 minutes or 30 minutes it was switching different channels for its Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I don't have enough free Wi-Fi channels around here. It's bumping into all the other Wi-Fi channels that are going on. Maybe what I need to do is shut off the Wi-Fi router on my Comcast modem, and then my own internal network, which includes two different access points over different sets of channels, would have less problems.
Can I do some translation?
Yeah.
Okay, first off, when you get a connection from your house to your service provider, whether that's DSL or cable or something else, the front end of that is called a modem. And that traditionally, a traditional modem used a phone line, and there's DSL?
Yeah.
DSL modems. And then there's also the box that connects to your cable company. That's a modem as well. Okay, so those are the modems. Those are connecting to the outside of your home. At the first,
and before any pedants email us, we're aware that a modem is an acoustic thing, as opposed to DSL and cable, which is not acoustic and therefore not a true modem, but
totally
modem is now the new term. So that's what we're using.
Yeah, we call that a modem, though it's not. Okay, but we'll call that a modem. Then right away, that that front end box that we call a modem, the first thing it does is it gives you some kind of Ethernet connection, and it can give you a Wi-Fi Ethernet connection or a plug Cat5 Ethernet connection. That's the one you plug in that looks like a fat phone line, or both of those at the same time. So when you get your cable box from Comcast or whatever, they give you one that has an Ethernet port on it, a plug, and also Wi-Fi that they provide. You can also buy your own, or sometimes they rent, whatever. You can buy your own modem and connect that up, depending if it's the right specs. And once you do that, you kind of own your network. So you were looking at the device that was Comcast. Do you lease it from them?
Yeah, I'm leasing mine currently.
So you lease it from them, so it comes with Wi-Fi, and it was on, and you were using that Wi-Fi that was on as kind of like a guest network because it's outside your network. And then from that box, it's going to your internal network, which then has a whole bunch of other stuff, and you had more access points.
Right.
Okay, so you were seeing that the channeling was switching. Wi-Fi uses multiple channels. There's 1 through 9,
well,
1 through 11?
On this one, there's 1 through 11, but that's really confusing. Because you can't think of it like channels on TV.
No, it's not. Because the frequency is all the same. So really, these are like pseudo areas of space. But they can actually conflict with each other.
And really, on the 2.5, is it 2.5? No, 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, which I'm using, there's really only three spaces in all of those channels that you can use without stomping and creating noise in the other channels.
And all of this noise that happens, like if you have your neighbors, they're also running networks, all the noise that happens basically just reduces the speed that you get because these things are really robust in reconnecting. So over time, given enough time, everything will work. But if you want to stream video or do something, you know, useful, like download a whole bunch of stuff, whatever, you run into these kind of noise problems with other networks and everything gets really, really slow.
Right. So people in cities have a terrible problem with this. I'm way out in the country and haven't had to deal with this much. But through this whole process, I tried to get as much Wi-Fi signal out of my house as possible. So it's just the ones that I was controlling. With Comcast, they not only allow you to have a Wi-Fi signal for your own network use, they have a second Wi-Fi signal that they will use as well. Because they have made their Xfinity network, which anybody with an Xfinity login can get on. And
no, they say anybody with an Xfinity login can use and get on. But in reality, they're almost always bad and horrible. I hate that service.
Right.
So
right.
What you're saying is you're paying for a service for them, and then they're extending their sellable network by using the connection, the thing that's in your house. You're paying for electricity on it.
Yep.
And they are resharing that Wi-Fi, polluting your Wi-Fi space, and then also letting other people connect through your network. And of course, you're paying for the connection, which is a minimal, you know, there's a restricted size to cable connections. So it's nasty.
The selling point is that if you're out and about and you see an Xfinity one, you can get on that one. And all
except for it never works.
No, it doesn't. Also, what it does is it grabs your iPhone, takes it off of the LTE network onto the bad Wi-Fi network and makes it so you don't have a connection.
Do you have this problem too, Miles?
No, I don't use the Xfinity.
You just turn it off, totally shut down. So, me too. I hate the thing, and I've actually forgotten it from my phone.
In all my devices, I've removed it so that this doesn't happen.
But it was still being served from your house.
It was, and I never really thought about it. I've known about it, but I just didn't want to deal with it. So I called Comcast up, and I said, Would you turn this off, please? And they said, sure, we'll do it. And they said, and I said, well, I'm looking at the router right now at the interface, and it says wireless is still on. Oh, don't just ignore that. Don't worry about that. I've turned it off. So I was a little bit concerned about this. I wasn't sure.
Did you restart it?
Yeah. Well, we restarted it. Did all of the normal things, and the tech assured me that he had logged in and turned off the Xfinity portion of the Wi-Fi. So I was trying to figure out whether there's something else going on, and I ran across this little tool. It's available for the Mac, and they actually have a Windows version that isn't fully feature complete yet, but it's called NetSpot.
What does it do?
This little tool is really nifty. It allows you to draw a map of your property. In my case, I have an old property map, so I just loaded up this property map, just an image, and I can go to any spot on my property, mark that on the map that's in the computer, and it will scan all of the Wi-Fi signal in that spot. And if I go to enough spots around my house or around my property, it will show me all the different Wi-Fi networks that are reaching that spot and reaching all across my property and what their signal noise.
Does it kind of triangulate and give you a location?
Yeah. It does more than that. It gives you a whole image of what the quality of the Wi-Fi signal is at that spot. So you get a whole graphic of each Wi-Fi. There's probably, I saw almost 20 different Wi-Fi networks on my property.
How many Xfinity broadcasts?
Oh, there was at least six of them.
Oh my God, it's so frustrating.
And one of them was emanating from behind my TV after the guy told me it was off.
You knew it was, yeah.
So I called him up again, and that guy actually did turn it off. So what was really cool about this tool, though, is I could see in each of the different channels that are broadcasting in the Wi-Fi space, and I was focusing on the 2.4 gigahertz space, I could see if there's any other Wi-Fi access point around my property that might be interfering and what channel it was on.
Cool.
And ultimately, once I got that Xfinity
off,
I could see that the only strong signals left were the two that I was controlling. So nice. That made me happy. I got them both on completely opposite ends of the channel spectrum. And ever since then, all the devices that I had little niggling problems with have so far been much, much more stable. I haven't had any problems
news.
At all.
Yeah. Let me just make one recommendation to you. A while ago, it took me about 2 years, maybe 3 years, of having Comcast and paying them for a leased modem. I finally went and figured out and bought an upgraded Motorola modem that worked on... Every time I say modem now, Miles, I'm thinking about what you said. You're right, it's not acoustic. Damn it! Digital modem. Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay. And I bought it, and it was like $50, right? So that's 10 months of lease, because they're $5 a month at least. And it does not have a Wi-Fi access point in it at all,
so,
which is kind of cool.
So I have done this in the past.
Yeah.
And I have had them fail on me in the past. In fact, I've had... two Comcast ones that I leased fail on me, and I had the one that I bought go out of spec. It was.
And the other thing that's frustrating about this is if you have a problem like this, you have to call Comcast unless you can have the modem fake a MAC address, because they lock your account to the MAC address of that modem. And so if you swap it out, it won't work anymore unless you call them and say, my new MAC address is. And then, of course, you have to get through that. That's the reason I never upgraded. I didn't want to have the conversation with them about how to do it. Anyway.
And that's why I never leased. I just bought the thing to begin with and just have my own device.
That's good too, right? You bought it with the service, right?
Right.
And that way you
own it. Because
it
pays for itself within a year.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So I have other reasons that I still lease it. But interesting, in this process, you know the whole game with cable TV and now cable internet,
yeah.
That you get these promotions. They last for 6 months or a year or whatever, and then the price goes up. And the game you're supposed to play is to call back every time and get the latest promotion or whatever. So in this process, they signed me up for the next promotion, and which was fine. I know the game.
You'll do it.
This is the choice I have.
You're
it's
on top
fine.
Of it.
But they upgraded me to I'm going to get this wrong.
Faster
now.
Network.
Oh yeah, faster network. 80 megabits per second. Yeah. 80 megabits per second.
Have you noticed the difference?
It's faster. Now, the problem is I don't know how to test it in a way that I know that Comcast is not gaming it. Because, of course, all the speed test sites out there, Comcast looks for that pathway and makes sure you get the absolute maximum speed from that. But
BitTorrent?
BitTorrent. But you got to have a point at the other end of that you... no, you don't. Because it's pulling from everywhere.
Get a Linux ISO BitTorrent.
Meaning, like, what kind of file to download?
Yeah. A large file that is not copyright encumbered in terms of restrictions.
And then you're not breaking any rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's perfect.
BitTorrent will saturate your network.
Yeah. Deluge. Deluge is the BitTorrent app that I'm using right now. It's really quite good. And it will tell you how much bandwidth. And just use only one file, and it'll show you how quickly it's downloading, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that'll be the way. That's what I got to try.
We could transfer some files between our houses, and we'll be two-way. But the cool thing about the BitTorrent that Miles is kind of clarifying is that you will get your download speed and your upload speed, because if you get a file that's popular enough, I don't know if Linux distros are going to be popular enough.
Well, it depends on whether or not it's just being released.
Yeah.
Just released ones will.
Yeah.
A good pirated file. Movie will definitely get you good upload speeds.
Yeah. You were saying?
No, that's fine.
Anyways, yeah, no, but I did notice the speed difference. It's okay. But now we're approaching those speeds that we've been talking about are so in the U.S. we've been so behind, and it's encouraging to see at least Comcast upgrading their network to the point where we can get speeds like that.
Hey, we're gonna keep talking about network and other stuff too. In fact. A lot of network today, oddly enough. Yeah, mostly a Wi-Fi show. So stick with us, won't you? This is Geek Speak. We'll be right back. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to Independent Public Radio, KOSP. With me in the air room is Brian Young and Miles Elam. Miles, what's up with New York and Wi-Fi? Today's Wi-Fi show, by the way, just to be clear. We are talking about
or
Wi-Fi.
Or networking in general.
Networking in general.
I remember we covered a story about New York City putting public Wi-Fi or all around the city. In other words, all those old public payphones that they found no one was using anymore because everyone has a cell phone now. They already have network drops.
Right. They've got telephone drops and they've got power. And they're spread out evenly throughout the cities. Perfect.
Right. So New York has actually started doing its install of public gigabit Wi-Fi.
Cool.
Now, as
gigabit
for
Wi-Fi, what does that mean? What protocol is gigabit Wi-Fi? I didn't think we could get gigabit Wi-Fi.
Sure, we can. AC 802.11ac is gigabit.
Oh, okay, cool.
Or it can be. And you're also talking about what the drop probably is to the section, and then you have 100 people connected to a node, and then you're slower than that. But what they're setting up to be is these Wi-Fi hotspots that also have USB charging stations.
Oh, really? That's a good idea.
And a 55-inch advertising display that's supposed to generate $500 million in revenue
that
over the next 12 years.
Pays for all of this. Yeah,
that's the idea, yeah. You have to pay for it somehow.
Wait, so can you just get free USB charging, or do you have to pay money or something to get the power?
I don't know.
You have to stare at the screen over and over.
That'd be kind of hard to deal with charges on that, especially because the power output doesn't seem like it's all that...
It's not going to cost much money, but but it does have to be paid for. So I guess the advertising billboard seems like it would probably pay for it.
So I've seen these Wi-Fi, not Wi-Fi, sorry. I've seen these device charging areas in some of the malls around here.
Oh, really?
Where you put your device in a locked space. I mean, you put it in there and plug it in.
A locker?
It locks up and you can walk away. But I mean, each device has its own little locker. Is that the kind of thing that they're doing? Or is it the kind of thing you're going to stand there and let it charge?
I'm assuming you stay there and let it charge, but I'm not sure.
You covered this story a long time ago.
Yes, I did.
So they're finally installing the first one?
They're finally...
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, they are loading it up. Yeah.
That's very cool. I kind of want to find out how long it's been since New York has talked about it. All right. Well, since we're talking about networking, let's talk about the 20th anniversary of something really cool that is yet to really be fully realized.
You ready to get geeky?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we've been using the internet for quite a while, and it all runs on IPv4. And everybody just eyes just glazed over. So
we talked about it on the show before.
Yeah. So down at the very lowest level of how our networks work is these packets, and these packets get sent.
That's not the lowest level, but keep on going. Sorry.
Well, you get down to just
radio signals, right?
Electrical signals below that.
There's a whole stack.
I was thinking, can we cut to the chase and just say, okay, we started off with phone numbers, and then we found out that we were running out of phone numbers, so now they had to put in area codes and country codes. So a whole bunch of more numbers to uniquely identify each phone.
And that's what IPv6 is?
Yes.
That's not very geeky at all. That was a complete metaphor. A technical metaphor, but...
But I mean, I wanted to move on to get to the actual story, because we've explained IPv6 multiple times.
Of course, the area code is so long that you can't even comprehend how many numbers that is. It's like billions upon billions upon billions of numbers.
Right.
That's kind of important. There's a lot of these numbers. So IPv6 is
each grain of sand on the planet could have its own phone number.
Yes.
No, each grain of sand on the planet could have a subnet that could have a million phone numbers. It's insanely big.
So we've talked many times about how IPv4 is running out of space. In fact, there are no more numbers to be allotted by... is it ICANN that allots those?
Mm-hmm. And Aaron for North America.
Yeah, and so all of the companies that have IPv4 numbers that they're handing out, that's the last numbers they get to hand out unless they start bartering on the open market for ones that people want to sell. So IPv6 gets rid of this problem because now we have a much, much larger space of numbers to hand out. And this system, this protocol, this IPv6 is now 20 years old. Let's have a party.
Oh, that's when the original request for comments was published. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was released 20 years ago.
It doesn't seem like it's moved very quickly.
No, not at all. There's a great article by Ars Technica that talks about all the different things that have come out and improved. Like Wi-Fi didn't even exist when IPv6 was ratified as a standard.
Awesome. Yeah. In fairness, they had to get IPv6 while still having IPv4 work.
Right.
And have them work together. Sure. And so it was not people necessarily just Keel Dragon.
I've been working on migrating the GeekSpeak server instance to a new server instance and doing a whole bunch of stuff. We talked about probably have on the post show stuff because we have some recording about that. But in doing that, I had to spin up a new instance, and I said to the current instance is in San Francisco, and I thought I'll spin up the second instance in New York. And you know, when it's asked me IPv6 support, I'm like, do I want to do this? I thought, you know, it could cause more trouble for me, so no. And I felt kind of guilty and bad about not saying yes.
You're
to that.
Part of the problem.
Part of the problem. But at the same time, then I got my instance and I got a new IP address. I'm like, oh yeah, look, an IPv4 address just came to me. Even though there's minimal, but DigitalOcean seems to have one, so that's cool. But anyway, it feels like those IP addresses are still kind of special, the IPv4 addresses.
Well, they have carrier-grade NAT nowadays. And
they're what?
Carrier-grade NAT.
That's right. Do you want to describe that?
In other words...
No, don't do that.
Don't do a metaphor. No, you have a single IP address going to an organization or a small pool of IP addresses, and it goes out to a very large number of customers. So think on the ISP level of hundreds of customers or thousands of people.
Well, it's just like Brian's local private network. All the computers on his private network have an IP address, and when they connect to the internet and get back, that's actually NAT. That's transferring the data back.
Yeah, network address translation is what NAT stands for. And it works okay when you have, you know, what, 5-10 devices in your home?
Well, it works okay as long as you're not trying to do certain different things like... all the video streaming protocols going from point to point, they have to really negotiate this in a tricky way, and sometimes they fail unless your router is helping them out a little bit or something like that.
Yeah.
So,
but they do a reasonably good job. I have to say they do a reasonably good job. Carrier grade NAT though, just when you increase the number so much, becomes a real headache, especially because each of those customers has another NAT.
This is
for their home network.
Yeah, this is just like an apartment complex, right? In an apartment complex, you have your address, which is the entire apartment building, and then you have a room or a apartment number. And so if the mail carrier carries it and drops it off at the front desk, and at the front desk they then take those things and put it in the mailboxes, there's a second layer of complexity to all the mail you get, and it gets delayed a little bit. Now, this is minimal. But that's what we're talking about with this this translation, is that there's a second post office, if you will, in the middle of all your communications, which is slightly...
And then
noisy. You
have roommates, so you have to divvy it out once it gets back to the house.
That's when you got a bad network. That's when you get roommates. College roommates are equivalent to bad network.
So IPv6 is going to get rid of all of this. We won't need NAT anymore. But guess how many people are actually using IPv6? How much of the internet is actually running on it right now?
2%.
Wow, you really are pessimistic.
It's more than that? That's good.
No, actually, we are up to 25% in the United States.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
Now, my home Wi-Fi router and the Comcast modem, I know that they're capable of IPv6, so I'm sure a large chunk is coming from systems like that. It's funny. It's actually the home internet that is is using it more than business internets are.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes sense when you take
most people don't know how to use their home router beyond the basic setup. The basic setup is doing it, and now the ISPs are doing IPv6, so you have an IPv6 address.
Yeah, and there's a lot less layers between you and the ISP when you're a home internet user. When you've got a big business that you're setting up all of your internal routers and all of your network gear, they might not be set up for IPv6.
Right, and there's a good reason for that, because most businesses are like, is it working now? Yes. Well, don't mess with it. No need to spend money on that. We have other things to worry about.
Yeah. You know, I got to say, with IPv6, one of the reasons why it concerns me a bit is that I understand more than I ever want to about IPv4. I've run bind servers. I know how to configure DNS. Like, I understand that system really pretty quite well, you know? Mm-hmm. I can basically look at a number and understand what submask it's in
rug from under your feet here.
I now know nothing about IPv6. Right, exactly. And that's what kind of stopped me from wanting to do that for the GeekSpeak server, because it's like, well, that's going to slow me down. I agree that if you're going to buy a new system from someone and it says it has IPv6 support and you have relatively new computers in your home, why not? Like, there's no reason, because it's all going to work for you. It's the other side of it when you're actually doing the hosting and actually configuring all that stuff. Is the SSL certificate have to have that IP address in it if you're doing IP-based SSL? Well, I don't do IP-based SSL anymore, so it probably doesn't matter. You know, like, there's all these complexities. Just in general, Apache, how does it work from Apache's perspective? The IP address is an IPv6 address.
Well, the IP address is stored as a string. So that that's just the host name. Yeah, so that's fine. So putting anything in there, including an IPv6, works. But then again, that number is so unwieldy, chances are you want to do it based upon domain name.
It's funny though, I say Apache because that was my like old pain with domain names and virtual hosts and all that stuff. Actually, I don't even use Apache anymore, right? I'm doing, I don't know, Nginx or something. And probably there's examples out there. So I guess the migration is slowed down by people like me being timid. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the only thing that's going to speed it up is when people run into too many headaches with what we have now.
Yeah.
But if you set it up on IPv6, the GeekSpeak server, would anybody still be able to connect? Or are there
going
to be...
It gets both IP addresses, what it says.
Right.
So that's the thing, is I'd have to figure that out. I guess what I'll do, you know what? I'll do that. I'll do it and I'll talk about it on the show at some point.
And he wipes his forehead.
Yeah, I can talk about Ruby on Rails and how painful that is. In fact, if you want to hear more about geeky stuff, listen to the post show of the podcast. You can get to the podcast by going to iTunes and looking up KOSP Geeks or GeekSpeak KOSP. That's the show. And we sometimes seem to be lately putting more content on the podcast at the end that's not, you know, that people might want to turn off. Spoiler alerts, you know, spoilers and things like that. But we give you warning. Any case, by the way, the New York kicks off payphone hotspot experiment was on the July 14th, 2012 episode of GeekSpeak. So if you want to go to the... So we're talking a long time since New York said they're going to do it to when they actually launched it.
It's only 3.5 years. Come on. Yeah, IPv6 has been 20 years.
That's true. That's true. Good point.
Oh, by the way, just as a public service announcement, if you go to ipv6test.google.com, you can find out whether or not you can access IPv6. For example,
wait, what's the address?
ipv6test.google.com. And the thing is, Lyle, you do not have IPv6 here at your house, they are doing a 4-to-6 router that allows you to access IPv6 websites.
How do you know that I don't have IPv6 at the house?
Because I'm looking at the readout from Google that says, no problems detected, you don't have IPv6, but you shouldn't have problems on websites that add IPv6 support.
It's slower, though. I'm having some slow access to this. So wait,
it's slower.
Are you using IPv6? I recall you have IPv6 at your place, and we both have Comcast. Is that because I bought my own modem?
I have no idea.
Well, the modem's configured by Comcast, so maybe it's your router.
No, my modem's not configured by Comcast. I bought my own. I configured it myself.
I as well. And who knows? Maybe it's it might be my airport or my time capsule that is doing a 6-to-4 translation. I don't know.
I got to look it up. I got to figure it out. We're going to do it right now.
Because I know that it can, or it may have an IPv6 address ready to go. I know Comcast was doing IPv6 as a rollout.
So, well, we've talked about Wi-Fi. We've talked about IP networking, which, of course, is Wi-Fi and normal Ethernet connections. But we haven't talked anything about mobile networks, cellular carriers. You got a story on cellular?
Well, this is a bit of follow-up from last week when we talked about how the FCC was starting to look into the variety of carriers and both wired and wireless on net neutrality and how they may be getting around the spirit of net neutrality. And one of the things we talked about was T-Mobile's Binge On service. I stumbled over the name last week, but thanks to lots of mails that we got, yes, it's called T-Mobile's Binge On. And one thing that was in question last week, which has now been confirmed, is the EFF ran some tests. And those tests show beyond a shadow of a doubt that when you are signed up to the T-Mobile Binge On service, you will have all of your HTML5 video throttled to the DVD quality that they say for the service. So the way T-Mobile was originally talking about this was it sounded like any of their partners would have their videos reduced in size, would be throttled back to only a data rate that is about DVD quality.
Mm-hmm.
But this, what came out last week was YouTube was accusing them of doing it to their videos and they're not a partner. Well, it turns out you can do the test yourself that any HTML5 going through their network that that when you're signed up to Binge On will get that same treatment. So
that makes a lot more sense to me. Have you clarified who are the partners with them that are doing this, or if it's just they're doing this to everybody?
No, they're doing this to everybody.
Right, but so do they even have partnerships?
Yes, they do, and that's what was all confusing is that
who are the partners that have actually announced this with them? Because they're using people's names, but I don't know if they're actually.
Yeah, I don't have a list in front of me. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, Netflix and YouTube are not partners, and they're some of the biggest video usage on the internet.
So this kind of works for a cellular carrier because if Comcast tried to throttle us to only be one video, it'd be problematic if our kids were watching video in a different room, right?
Sure.
Because then you have, you know, a bandwidth that can support one DVD quality video and you've got two feeds going at the same time, so the quality's gonna be really bad. But on a cellular carrier, it kind of makes sense, right? You've got your antenna and that thing can pump out a stream of data that's equivalent to a DVD quality video. That whole, by the way, idea that's DVD quality and all that, there's no way to say that about encrypted, about compressed video.
About streaming video.
Streaming video compression is not, you can't just say it's this quality. It's,
well, you can't say that about MPEG-2, which is what is used right on DVDs. It's already lossy there, just
right,
not
but
very.
I'm just saying in general, talking about video quality that's from lossless or loss sources, compressed sources is like talking about shades of color and saying what's the pinker color. You can't that doesn't have a meaning, right? These are subjective things.
It's a marketing term, but we both know when somebody in Hollywood makes a DVD, they're sitting there and they're trying all sorts of settings and they're choosing the best one. Even though the data rate might be lower or higher, there's an eyeball going into that.
Yes.
What we're talking here is an automated system that just reduces the data rate, and you may or may not see some bad artifacts in it mm-hmm. just because of that.
I mean, a great example of this is that if you take an animated movie and you compress it, not a 3D animated, but like a flat animated movie, and you compress it versus a normal traditional movie and you compress it, you can compress the animated movie a lot more without having the same kind of artifacts you have in the other video. But at the same time,
unless there's a lot of blacks.
Right. So that's the other thing is that the compression algorithm that was originally designed was for moving video, like television video. MPEG 2 was a television standard first. And so the actual television skin tones and all that stuff of like live or a people world rather than a flat world, the algorithms are actually designed for that. So you'll have different types of artifacts on the 2D content that's flat. So it's much more complicated than people normally tend to believe that it is. Is that interesting? No. Miles, down with that?
I was thinking the ability of the human perceptive system, sensing system, whether it be visuals, auditory, smells, taste, to detect accuracy is way too optimistic. Because that's the thing with compressed audio. When you talk on a cell phone, that is highly compressed audio. But it's compressed in such a way that the human brain doesn't know the difference. You can't hear the things that are missing.
Well, I'll argue that one. But I'll take your point, yeah. But that example is not a good example. Anyways.
Well, you probably have better ears than Miles does.
No, I don't. In fact, I've got friends who are audiophiles that love to compress their MPEGs at 300, or what was it, MP3s at 320, whatever it is.
Completely unnecessary.
Yeah. But I can't hear the difference where they say they can. But on the cell phone is so bad that I always switch over to Skype or to FaceTime or to any other system that uses much more... much better
Except
compression.
Except they're also using an audio codec.
Oh, they are. But your point is valid. All these codecs take all this data and just compress it down to just what's perceptible.
And also task-driven. So if you try to record a symphony on an audio codec, it's going to sound horrible.
You mean on a voice codec?
A voice codec. Sorry. Thank you. And if you record voice on a music codec, it sounds pretty good, but it also takes up a lot more size. It takes up a lot more space. And that's the trade-off.
Definitely. All right. We're going to talk more about you know what? You'll find out what we talk about, but I promise you it'll be interesting here on GeekSpeak. We'll be right back. This is GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm with Brian Young and Miles Elam. We've been covering a whole bunch of stories. One thing I want to mention is that Grant C. actually wrote in to correct that the T-Mobile project was called
Binge On. And pointed us to the article about the EFF testing their Binge On service.
And that's the important thing, is that the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is like what we talk about a lot on the show. You can look it up, EFF.org. And they take a look at consumer concerns online and in the digital age. And so they're taking a look at, like, what does it actually mean? And they're the ones that discovered that actually they're restricting all your bandwidth when you sign up for this process. But at the same time, you have unlimited bandwidth with this service, which is kind of cool. Unlimited because you're maxed out at the connection speed.
Did you just say that was cool? We just talked about this last week, Lyle. You're going to make me bring all that back up?
Well,
No. Yes.
I'm saying that
the consumers can get a lot of video.
Yeah, no, okay. But see, that's the thing, is they're not restricting per... If they're just restricting everybody, it is cool. Last week, we talked about it being a partnership and it not being equivalent to... that they would target some connections that would be preferred. And so the video providers that were preferred, had relations with them, would be... would hold on. We talked a lot about this last week, so listen to last week's show. What I'm saying is, if they're just throttling the network, period, it doesn't affect anything. It is net neutral. That user has a restricted network. Totally the same for everybody. That's cool. That's the way to implement it. They did good, if that's true.
I got to think over that one. I'm dubious about that. You're right. It is neutral to all video providers on the web.
Yeah. Cool. So, what's AT&T doing, Miles?
Well, AT&T is following with other carriers. It looks like phone subsidies are going the way of the dodo.
What do you mean phone subsidy? Like when I buy a phone?
Mm-hmm. And so you go and you get that new handy-dandy smartphone, and it's only $200, except that the smartphones actually cost $650 or $850 or more.
And that money comes out of...
It comes out of the subscription. Over the next 2 years or so, usually the standard contract, you are paying a little bit of that phone down every month. But now it's looking more like you're going to see initiatives like AT&T Next, which is talking about, here's this fee, you have the AT&T service, and you get your phone, but it isn't based upon... Here's your upfront cost for the phone, and then you're getting the service. You're just paying that higher price for the service,
and oddly, you're after the contract runs out and you've paid off the phone, you seem to keep the higher fee, higher monthly fee.
Although you can choose to get a new phone,
and that's the thing is that I've told people before, if you're out of contract, you should go buy a new phone because you're actually wasting money if you don't. Right. So they're stopping this process completely? Why? Why is AT&T really shutting this down?
Well, I don't know AT&T's motives. I don't work for AT&T. At the same time, I do know that phones that have a really good feature set are getting cheaper. Like the amount that people would need, a acceptable level of clarity in the camera, fast enough music playing and video playing, for example, getting at that HD resolution, perhaps even outputting to a TV, a Bluetooth. So with those same specs, you know, why are you paying for a phone that goes so much faster once you have everything that you need?
But Miles, that's always been the case. Like, oh, the laptops now are so great. You don't need a new one. I mean, they always are going to increase and get better.
But that is the rationale behind many laptops being much cheaper. Especially the Chromebooks, because even these things that just connect, you have to be online all the time, are now usable. They're now viable, that you would only pay $200 for a laptop.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's kind of a cool idea to do that. The thing that I like about it is that people be more aware of what they're spending and why they're spending what they're spending.
Wait a second. I got to call shenanigans on that, because all these different programs that the cell phone companies are coming out with are actually still hiding the upfront cost. It's just that they end after you've paid off the phone, which is a good thing.
But they will also offer options, as far as I'm aware, that if you buy the phone yourself outright, then you won't have to pay the extra fees.
No, it's true. It's true, Brian, that they are still wrapping them in a monthly payment, but they're disconnecting it from your service.
Yeah, which is great.
So there's a little more clarity about what you're actually paying for.
No. I have been calling for that for eons. As a fantastic thing in that way.
I'm curious why they're doing it.
Well, I mean, it started with Sprint and T-Mobile putting pressure on Verizon. And
I think Apple put pressure on them too.
How did Apple do it?
I could be wrong, but Apple provides their own service now, where you can buy their phone through them, and do a monthly payment?
They do.
Right.
And
so
it's particularly good if you wanted to upgrade every year, I believe. It actually provides a system for that. But this has been years in the making since T-Mobile, I think, was the first one about 3 years ago, was really pushing for people to bring their own devices before they even had the iPhone on their network. And that kind of pressure made the leading carriers take notice. Mm-hmm. So it's always been an odd thing about the U.S. market to have this system where all the costs were hidden. So it's great to get those out in the open. It's great to give people the control and the choice. And
yeah, and as a point of reference, in the European Union, you're not locked to your phone. You're actually, it's against the law to tie a phone to a specific carrier.
And here it's also, oh, that's right. They're still locked here. I mean, you can theoretically buy a phone. Currently, though,
you can buy an unlocked phone now and get onto a service. But that whole time where it was an AT&T exclusive to have an iPhone, and then they branched out to Verizon and then later to Sprint, that doesn't happen in Europe.
That's cool.
Yeah, and on top of that, we have the whole LTE transition where it used to be we had the two dramatically different systems for all the cell phones, and you couldn't just take a device from one.
I thought the networks were still different. It's just that the phones all have antennas that can do both.
Well, they're now all using a flavor of LTE.
Oh, I know.
And even though some of the carriers support different radio frequencies than the others, the manufacturers have really pushed, and the chip makers like Qualcomm have really pushed to include more and more frequencies in their model of phone so that it gives you a chance not only to go from the U.S. to Japan and still be able to use your phone, but to be able to go from one service provider in America to another one.
Right. And that's what he was saying. And it is a different frequency in those different countries.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But we're getting to the point now where most phones come with most frequencies, and this is in just a few years we've really changed the system.
Yeah, Macs can now run Windows.
The LTE telecommunication wiki page, Wikipedia page has a map of the planet with the three different basic tech in them, which is pretty cool. But LTE does stand for long-term evolution. It's interesting because we used to have versions of tech that would change versions as it became backwards compatible. And now it seems like specs we design such that they never are backwards compatible. We always use the same term. And I never know if that's the public branding term or the technology term.
Well, it's like Bluetooth is a collection of how many different radio technologies.
Right.
And
you just throw it in that bag and then you have to, have a mess.
Protocols, right? Because they're all 2.4 gigahertz.
Well, like Bluetooth low energy has almost no relationship to the original Bluetooth spec. It's the frequencies and the
the frequency is the same. It's still 2.4 though.
I'm not sure about that. We'll look it up. But got another story for us today, sir?
Yeah. So this is really interesting. We've talked a lot about infrastructure in the United States, about allowing more and more people to get on the internet, and there's still a segment of the population that does not get on the internet at the digital divide.
Yeah, but people that don't have a network connection at home. I mean, we're talking about a pretty substantial amount of money per month.
Well, and in Spring Hill, Tennessee, they were noticing a second problem, not just with lower income people not having access to the internet, but their community was growing so fast that the internet providers couldn't bring internet to everyone's home.
The ISPs have not built infrastructure as fast as the area is growing. When you get high density growth without high telco density growth, you've got these inconsistencies. And that's not that uncommon. It's a little more rare than probably financial concerns. I think that one of those things that's amazing is that we've seen like the potential demise of the libraries for quite a while now. We see this idea that, well, people don't read books anymore, right? And then libraries are starting to stock music. And then people are putting everything on their MP, they're on their portable devices. They have everything they need. They don't need to go to the library. And libraries start doing like books on tape. And of course, good research features. And access to internet has been around libraries for a while, and it seems to be a real good community service.
And in Spring Hill, Tennessee, they decided to turn around and allow people to check out Wi-Fi, mobile Wi-Fi hotspots. So using...
What do you mean, check out from the library? Like, not just going to the library and hanging out there, but like checking something out and bringing it home with you?
Bringing a device home with you. Checked out for a normal period of time that you might check out a book. And
that's awesome.
Bringing Wi-Fi hotspots to your home, to your neighborhood.
Have you ever had one of these things that it's like, it's not a phone at all, it's just a dedicated mobile device that shares network with you?
I've used them. I borrowed them from work and things like that.
Yeah. I had one when I worked at the university. We used it for installation art. And I, whenever the students weren't using it for installation art or faculty weren't using it, I'd carry it around with me. And it was the earlier days, right? And it was amazing to have network like that. I mean, I was always kind of impressed. Still slow at that point. But now with LTE speeds, that's probably the, for especially like Spring Hill, which is one of these communities that is growing too fast, I guess. It seems like it'd be the best network connection you could possibly get.
Yeah, LTE has been better than my home internet most of the time until recent couple upgrades.
Miles, did you look up the Bluetooth thing?
I did.
And?
And they are both the classic Bluetooth and the new Bluetooth, smart Bluetooth or Bluetooth low energy, are both 2.4 gigahertz to 2.48 or something like that.
So I'm sorry to imply that the spectrum was different, but the technology behind it.
But a classic Bluetooth used 79.1 megahertz channels, whereas the new one uses 42 megahertz
channel width.
Yeah.
So they're different.
And the protocols are different.
But they're the same frequencies.
And there you go.
Okay. Is 88.9 the same frequency as 104.5?
No.
Okay.
Oh, but they're both FM.
Yeah. They're both in the same area of the network, but they're different
frequencies. Well, no, they overlap the exact same frequencies. They're just subdivided differently.
Okay. I'd have to look that up.
They're both on the 2.4 gigahertz unlicensed spectrum.
Yeah, but when you say 2.4 gigahertz spectrum, that's a broad range. That's like saying FM radio is the spectrum from 88 point something to... I mean,
okay, they both use the same spectrum range from 2.4 gigahertz to 2.4835 gigahertz.
Okay. Are they using phase modulation to separate themselves?
A frequency shift modulation.
Yeah, okay. All right, moving on, shall we?
Just in that same vein, so what's the problem with Bluetooth?
What do you mean, Bluetooth LE or Bluetooth main?
Well, in general, what's the downfall of Bluetooth? What can it not do very well?
Audio real time.
Yeah, it doesn't have a lot of bandwidth, a lot of throughput.
Yeah.
So there is a new standard.
This is the Wi-Fi one, right?
Yeah, there's another Wi-Fi story.
Well, Bluetooth, the whole point of that was not necessarily for fidelity, audio fidelity, or for example.
No, it wasn't designed for that.
It was to be very low power.
Well, that the most recent incarnation of Bluetooth, yes.
Even the original Bluetooth was meant to be low power. That was the point of the spec, as opposed to Wi-Fi.
I wouldn't say that was the point of the spec. It was a personal network space, and you did want low power. There was two things, right? Connectivity at a local level, and you know, don't use a lot of power. Well, but it wasn't like...
You were using a Bluetooth headset device or a mouse or something like that, which meant that the chances are they're going to be battery powered. Yeah. So low power was a part of the requirement.
Sure.
Yeah, but the engineering trade-off on that is that you can't put a lot of data through that very quickly. It has low throughput. So we're now in the dawning of the Internet of Things, and yet another flavor of Wi-Fi is... getting close to being ratified and coming out. You've heard of all the different alphabet soup after 802.11. We've talked about A and B and N and G, and I'm not even going to try to put them in the right order.
What was the gigabit one?
AC.
AC.
Well, now this latest one, which is called 802.11 AH. So, of course, because of alphabet soup, they had to come up with a marketing name for it. They're going to call it, and I don't know how to pronounce it, but it looks like Halo. As in hollow. It's pronounced like Halo?
Yeah, pronounced like Halo, but they can't spell it that way because Microsoft has the trademark on Halo.
So you have to say hollow?
No, you can say Halo. You just have to spell it hollow.
What's interesting about this is it's attempting to solve a similar problem as Bluetooth because it's really being targeted at Internet of Things, but it also is Wi-Fi, so it will... extend the range of some of the Wi-Fi devices that are going to use it. It's going to be in the 900 megahertz band, which is the old TV band. Is that what we used to use for television? I'm pretty sure. It's going to be unlicensed. But they're targeting this at Internet of Things because of the Bluetooth connections not going to be able to support such a large number of devices all around the house through all the different dense walls and all the other problems
that
you have.
And that's a high bandwidth option? Because 900 megahertz, I would think that would be good range for low power, but not necessarily...
The 33 centimeter or 900 megahertz band is a portion of the UHF radio spectrum initially allocated to amateur radio on a secondary basis. It ranges from 902 to 928 megahertz and is unique to ITU region 2. It is primarily used for very local communications as opposed to bands lower in frequency. So there you go. Not long range, I guess, which seems weird.
But compared to AC, I believe it does give you...
Well, relative to power output.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I believe you will get more range out of it than AC gives you and still get high bandwidth.
So does this mean that we have a promise of potentially lots of bandwidth? Because one of the things I wish we had better was that local device-to-device communication at high speed, because I'd love to be able to be more... like wireless headphones sounds great to me, but every time I tried Bluetooth, the quality's not good. The connection seems to have a hiccups in the connection. All
well,
that stuff.
And that delay comes from partly the throughput. In fact, one of the articles I read was talking about how Apple's HomeKit, which is supposed to tie all the Internet of Things devices together, because it requires such encryption to try to keep any hackers from getting into the system, keep them out. That encryption is creating too much work for the bandwidth available in Bluetooth, and the delay is just too long.
Okay, when people talk about Internet of Things, talking about a refrigerator, you know, your washing machine,
light bulbs,
whatever. What? Maybe you guys can answer this for me. What about those devices needs bandwidth?
And maybe we'll cover that next week here on GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know that we said hi. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org or email us and visit us on Twitter and Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks. And at email, we're geeks at geekspeak.org. This is GeekSpeak episode 1 of our 16th season. Our theme song is by Michael Newman. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me is Brian Young and Miles Elam. Thank you so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.
And also thank you, Greg, to our Canadian correspondent for support. We'll see you next week. In fact, online as well.
No, but seriously, like, you're talking about, like, oh, so, we need this bandwidth for the Internet of Things.
No, but that's just it. We rushed out on a part that was actually going to answer that question. So, trying to get the latency down on devices that have to stay encrypted in their communication. Apparently, Bluetooth is not handling that well. It's creating long delays for devices that are trying to talk to each other. So, obviously, Bluetooth headphones are not encrypted, but there's a long delay from pushing
Got
and start
it.
And
okay.
stop. So there's a latency problem based on
throughput?
On the encryption that's being...
The key negotiation and...
There's multiple things that we're jumping
the
around here.
Audio is also compressed. The MP3, I mean, the Bluetooth also compresses audio.
Yeah, and that's part of the system. I don't understand.
That's part of the delay
Wait,
as well.
Bluetooth compress? I thought it was simply... Bluetooth doesn't care. It's a transport mechanism. You're putting an audio codec that's heavily compressed through Bluetooth.
Right.
No, I think Bluetooth specs. Bluetooth does do a part of that.
I think the audio codec is a part of the Bluetooth spec.
Yeah.
But it is a different audio codec. So
keep
whatever
mind
your codec
that
on your
the
phone
target
is,
device has to be low power and all that Bluetooth stuff. And so its codec is actually specced in the Bluetooth spec. You know what? Maybe it's not that the compression algorithm is specced in the Bluetooth spec, but the handshaking has to clarify what audio.
Every time you hit the start stop.
I don't know, but that does have to happen because the target device might not be able to play the audio file. What's that?
That's just what causes the initial long latency when you hook up, though, isn't it? It's just the whole handshake procedure of exchanging keys and so on.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should have somebody on talk about Bluetooth. Is it really 2016?
It really is.
Hey, I had a flash. Since we started the show, I've said the date of the show in the beginning but I had to stop because for the broadcast, I had to stop. But I was thinking it's actually kind of hard if you've been listening to the show without the date to look it up. I was thinking about us providing seasons and episodes from now on out, using the season being the year that we're in broadcast and the episode be the numerical value of that year of the episode.
Not just record date?
Well, record date can't be set on air, but season and episode could be.
Wait, the season wouldn't be the year?
The season would be the year.
Okay, yeah. And then the episode would be the...
the numeric value of that year. Okay. You know, the episode. We're on episode 2 right now of season 819.
1602.
Well, no, the it started in 98. The show started in 98. So 1 would be, or 0 would be 3. So 16 plus 19. This is season 19.
Yeah, but are we going to try to count all the Cruise.io stuff, or are we gonna just going to count ourselves?
Well, if you think about the show and its duration, you should do the seasons, right? Or should it be when we started? Let me ask you this. If somebody replaced us and kept the show going, you wouldn't restart the seasons, would you?
How about just refer to the stuff that was Cruise.io as
pre,
the equivalent of BC?
Okay. Yeah, I like that. So we started in 2000. So that was season one.
Mm-hmm.
And we could start the seasons in 16. Or
season zero.
Season zero? You want to have 16 be the season?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the longer duration is better. Is a better
and rest count from zero. Plus, we only had, 4 months in 2000 anyway? So that's season zero.
It's true. Counting from zero is really geeky. I like that.
Okay.
This is Geek Speak episode 1 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio. Does that sound good?
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
And then I'm redoing the website because fucking Rails.
What are you going to now?
I'm staying with Rails.
No. You've got to switch over to a brand new library that's in Swift for Linux, and it's completely immature. It'd be perfect.
Does somebody have a Linux?
It's called Perfect.
No, Java EE. Java EE 7.
Wait, man. I spent 2 weeks with Groovy hating it, and I was refactoring this complexity. And end of last week and today, I started doing Objective-C, and I'm refactoring some hellish Objective-C stuff, and I'm loving it. So Java sucks. That's what I have to say about that.
Whatever.
Can you point to anything of why?
No. I just think I like UI code better than server code.
Oh, well, yeah. There you go.
I'm sure that's what it is. Because I get faster feedback. You're building a data model on the server side that it's like,
You're doing it wrong.
What do you mean?
Well, to get immediate feedback?
Immediate feedback over my functional tests. It's like, immediate feedback on UI code is like, ooh, pretty.
Instant gratification.
There's a pretty picture and it's gradient. Oh,
or work. Even when it's not a pretty picture, it's instant.
Yeah.
Look at that. I was actually thinking,
well, it's not instant.
I'm using NetBeans, I'm just able to change some code, hit refresh on the browser because it will auto deploy on save. And then I see the output.
Client code.
No, server code.
What's your output?
The output is the web page that is being
emitted.
That's
client.
No, I'm editing server code.
Where the code is not what type of code it is. You're doing UI code, right? What I'm saying is,
I'm not. This is talking about the data layer.
You're seeing a web page, though?
I am editing the data and business layers, and they are showing up on the client side.
As what?
As content.
As a UI. See, I'm doing my Groovy work, I'm just setting up something to later use on client. So all I have is raw JavaScript or JSON out.
Here's the deal. You're on client side. You make a change, and how do you check it? You hit refresh.
Yeah.
So I'm on server side, and I make a change, and I hit refresh.
No,
I
don't get
exactly
the
same.
I don't get to hit refresh. I have to run a Groovy functional test because all my Java modules have to be put up and deployed to some AWS instance in our cloud infrastructure and run something, and I get test data back.
Right.
There's browser refresh for me. That's what I'm saying, is it's like there is no UI front. It's just functional tests
that run and give me a pass or a fail. That's simply your environment that has nothing to do with how we would do it for ourselves. We could have a continuous integration server or something like that ran those tests, but actually developing it, you don't send it off and just have the test. You can start working on it and you get that immediate feedback. And then once you're done, you go like, oh, that looks good.
No, you're talking about having a client display something. You're having some browser, right? Some web browser do something? So you already have
or
a front
I send
end.
A text message or I do something
yeah,
else.
But you're not if you're what I'm talking about is client side code, I mean UI code, like UI interface, user interface stuff versus non-user interface stuff. So I like doing user interface stuff. So when I'm doing something like in Groovy that's not user interface stuff, then it's just not as enjoyable for me. It's probably not the language, is what I'm saying. It's not Groovy as the language. It's just that there's not fast feedback in the pattern I'm using.
Well, I'm saying there is fast feedback. It's a different kind of feedback. It is not user experience.
It's
data integrity, but it's still feedback, immediate feedback.
Okay, so every time I write and save the code, I have a test that's running in the background. It's immediate feedback. I get tons of terminal outs with red or green. Woo, yay. It's not rewarding. It's ugly.
But that's how you are doing it. I'm saying that is not intrinsic to server-side code.
I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that I don't like non-user interface work as much as I like user interface work.
I think
so
the problem
when my interface is crap, it's not interesting to me.
I hope you're recording this.
I am for all of it.
You don't understand. The way I've been doing user interface code is better than the way I have been doing server code, even though server code could be done differently.
Therefore, I hate Groovy and love Objective-C. I love it.
No. That's exactly what you were saying.
I am totally saying that I like developing in user interface space. And the reason why I don't like Groovy right now is because all my Groovy work is non-user interface.
Except
that's
that
what I was saying.
You made the assumption Java sucks.
No, I said...
No, you...
No, listen to me.
You can go
I
back
said,
and get the recording, because you said the words Java sucks.
Yes, and then I said, actually, probably what it is that I'm not doing user interface work in Groovy. I'm doing it in Objective-C, and that's probably why I like that more, because I like user interface stuff more. And then you argued with me about it. The reason why I said Groovy sucks, Java sucks, actually, it's probably because I'm not doing user interface work in it. And then you argued with me.
Is calling core data and doing persistence UI work in Objective-C?
No.
Okay, so you don't like that either?
No.
Which has nothing to do with the language?
Right.
Okay.
That was my whole point, is that it's really the reason I'm tainted by Groovy is that I'm not using it the right way. At the same time, do you do any Groovy work? Is there any Groovy like web browser page creation stuff?
Yeah.
Or UI work?
Yeah.
Is there a good library for it?
It's called Groovy on Grails.
Is it good?
There are a lot of people who like it. I didn't much care for Groovy. That was mostly because historical. One, I was already good at Java,
right.
So I didn't need an easy introduction to Java.
Well, and closures now exist in Java, so...
Closures now exist in Java.
Is string manipulation okay in Java? Because Groovy's string manipulation is pretty good.
It is not as good as Groovy. Java still doesn't have multi-line strings, which is annoying.
Have you looked at JavaScript ECMA6's multi-line string support template support? It's pretty cool, huh?
I've been using it in my project.
Awesome. Are you just doing contemporary browsers?
Yeah. For my own personal projects, I don't have time for older browsers. I'm just gonna.
All right.
You support ECMA6 or whatever the polyfill can handle, but. Yeah, there's no...
And by the time you finish developing it, it's going to be at least...
Exactly.
What?
That's exactly what I was thinking, actually.
There's no news in this document.
You're not looking at the right doc, then.
Oh, we're in section 2. Whoops.
Oh. That's okay.
We're just going to skip the first section of the show. You're going to extemporaneously just talk about the advantages of UI coding.